BCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
Well, hi, and welcome to Crosstalk on VCY America. Glad you could join us today. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time of year, we reflect upon Passion Week, the triumphal entry of Jesus Christ, the Last Supper, the Garden of Gethsemane, the betrayal of Jesus, his death, his burial, and his resurrection. Sometimes we recite these as just facts of history without fully realizing the many issues involved. Well, today we're going to delve further into the trial of Jesus, and as we do so, we welcome in our studio today Randy Melchert. Randy does have a bachelor's in Bible, a master's in Christian thought, another master's in rhetoric and public address, and a Juris Doctor degree. He is a licensed attorney, Christian school administrator, researcher and consultant, and author of the book Secrets of the Trial of Jesus, and producer of the DVD, The Trial of Jesus. Randy, good to have you with us here on Crosstalk.
Thank you for having me with you today.
Randy, also a member of our board of directors here at VCY America. And Randy, since we have the account of the trial of Jesus laid out in the Gospels, why do you use the term secrets?
Well, part of it is a lot of time as we're reading through the gospel narrative, and we come to, especially with the Easter season, we talk about the agony in Gethsemane. We talk about the crucifixion, but we kind of gloss over some of the aspects of the trial itself, and especially the buildup to the trial. We see trials today, you know, famous trials like the O.J. Simpson trial. We're obsessed as a society with trials, but we often neglect the buildup to it, especially throughout the Gospels. We can see different aspects as we see the prosecutor, we see the jury, we see different aspects throughout the entire Gospel account of this battle to try to indict and prosecute Jesus Christ.
Perhaps the biggest question you address in your book is why Jesus came to earth. Some thought that it was just to solve some political problems or some other problems, but you write that Jesus came to solve a legal problem. What is this legal problem that you're referring to?
Well, and this legal problem is the special issue. Today, we have people who are focusing on social justice. You know, they think it was a political problem. He was marching for social justice. You know, other people, we can turn on TV and hear how he came to solve a financial problem. He wanted to make us healthy, wealthy, and rich. Some people think that, well, maybe we had a paternity problem. We didn't know that we're all God's children. No matter what we believe, we're all of his children.
Yeah, we hear that.
Yeah, we hear, well, you know, he solved an emotional problem. We just got to learn to love ourselves. We hear, well, maybe it's just a medical problem, that we're just sick people. We need to achieve full actualization. What the Bible tells us is that Jesus' trial, and that's what's so neat, is as it points to this legal problem that we had, not so much even that he had, but that we had. We were guilty men condemned to die, shortly awaiting execution. Jesus came to solve our legal problem, and what's amazing is how it's portrayed in his legal trial.
The word justification is very important in your book and the matter that we're discussing today. What exactly is justification?
Justification is the problem of mankind. How can a guilty man be set free? How is it that when we have a trial, all right, we're sitting here on trial, we're indicted with our sins, say to the prosecutor who, for us, brings against us, points us to the divine law. We take a look at the Ten Commandments. If you've seen Ray Comfort, he does a great job. He'll ask somebody in the street, do you think you're a good person? Oh, sure, I'm a good person. Well, have you ever told a lie? Yeah, everybody tells a lie. Well, what does that make you? A liar. You ever stolen anything? Doesn't matter how small. Yeah. What does that make you? A thief. All right. All of a sudden, you know, Ray Comfort in 10 seconds says somebody admitted to be a lying thief, yet still claims to be a good person. So how do we take a guilty lying thief, and God says that you have to be perfect to go into heaven, how do we make that person righteous, innocent? Satan is glad to prosecute mankind. He knows where he's going. He wants us to join him. He's glad to present the indictment. But then what is the answer for man? That we are guilty, we're condemned to die, we're facing execution. How did Jesus come in to deal with that situation? And that's what justification is. It's not about just making helping us declare victory over our self-esteem issues. Jesus came to solve our legal problem, where guilty men, condemned to die, can be righteously set free. That's what justification is.
Randy, you write about the judicial nature of God. What is God's judicial nature, and why is that important?
Well, judicial is so much fun, especially today in America, because we get wrapped up in court trials, even Supreme Court elections. Millions of dollars will be spent on electing one person to a state Supreme Court. We had the entire presidential election. Much of the focus was on who the president would appoint to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was estimated that 100 million people stopped what they were doing when the O.J. Simpson verdict came out. All right, we think of judicial as almost kind of an American system, whether it's the Gene Zimmerman trial. By the way, do you know how much money Judge Judy makes in the average year? $47 million. Mm. And it's a fake courtroom, okay? I mean, she's not, sentencing people. It's arbitration. So she really has no more authority in her position than either you or I would have. If I say, hey, I've got a dispute with my neighbor, he says it's his, he says it's mine, we agree to have you, Jim, as being our dispute resolution person. Judge Judy is doing the same thing. Alternative dispute resolution is the technical term, but she gets paid $47 million to handle judicial issues. Now, the real issue we have in America is we think that this is almost kind of entertainment, unless it's you personally. I've had to represent people in traffic court. Sometimes it's small things, some things it's big things. And so there's, you get to the long line in traffic court, and we think of this as an American idea. But as we look throughout the Bible, we see the judicial nature of God. No sooner had man's ears been formed, within a few verses of Adam's ears being formed, one of God's first words to him was the first criminal statute in history. Now, we look through, pick up the copy of your statutes for your state, the criminal law, and it says, if you do this, then here's the consequences. If you commit first-degree homicide, you'll be subject to a Class A felony and some areas of the death penalty. What we see, one of the first verses of the Bible said that if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. You have a criminal statute in Genesis chapter 2. What's amazing is we go throughout the Bible, we see not only more of these statutes. Genesis 9, we have capital punishment, where God's instituting that. We see as we're looking especially in the Mosaic Code, where we're seeing as it's developing on there, the 613 laws that God gave to Moses. And what's fascinating is especially when you compare some of those to some of the other ancient systems, God had a totally different judicial philosophy than even you pick up Hammurabi or some of these other secular codes. Makes for a fascinating outlook when you look at the Bible from a legal perspective.
Okay, so you brought up the institution of capital punishment, Genesis 9, verse 6. Why is that even important to our topic today?
Well, because sin has consequences, especially going back to the first sin and what we see throughout there. We look in the New Testament. Romans 6:23 tells us that the wages of sin is death. Sin has consequences. Now, a lot of times people say, one of the fun things that people try to point out to you is they say, well, God, why did God order the destruction of the Canaanites? God instituted death penalty for the Canaanites? But God, being our creator, had the right to set up laws because of these laws that he set up for his creation. And that's especially why Genesis is so important. If God didn't create us, God did not have any authority to set up these laws. We have these laws set up pointing out that there is consequences for sin. A violation of his law, as is seen throughout the New Testament, that sin results in death. Sin results in separation from heaven. How can we, as guilty people, deal with our legal problem? And that is why Jesus had to come.
So you see a connection then between our law, our criminal today, and the scriptures themselves?
There's even examples that we have to point to. Adultery is an offense that our society doesn't like to talk about. But in Leviticus 20, verse 10, it says that the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, all right, so you have the elements of the crime, okay? So you got to make sure that there must be a man, there must be somebody had to be married, that there had to be a marriage, and there had to be an act of adultery. So you have your elements of it. Then Leviticus 20:10 says, the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. That you have a consequence, a legal consequence. Wisconsin, statute 944.16. Here we have the consequence first. Whosoever does either of the following is guilty of a Class I felony. And it lists a married person who has intercourse with a person, not the married person's spouse, or a person who has intercourse with a person who's married to another. You have these same elements that you have in the Bible. You have a slightly lesser penalty, a Class I felony instead of capital punishment. But you actually have statutes that Moses was given over 3,000 years ago that are still on the books in our states today. The basis of our system comes from the Bible. Even more fascinating is this concept of torts. Now, torts is just kind of a fancy word for negligence. We hear about people who spill coffee on their laps, and they sue because the person selling them coffee had a duty to make sure that it wasn't going to create intense harm. Did you know that that came from the Bible? Back in the Bible, we have this whole idea of torts that comes from Deuteronomy 22, verse 8. Back in the Old Testament days, you'd have go up on the rooftop in your house. You wouldn't necessarily go out to your backyard. You would go to your rooftop. It'd be a cool day in the evening, and you'd sit up on the roof, and you'd invite your friends over to the top of your roof. Well, what happens when some of the people who are on your roof, it's dark out, if they trip, and if they were to fall off your roof and get injured? Well, that's their fault. They should have been looking, right? No, it was your duty. Under Mosaic laws, your duty as the homeowner, you knew that there was a potential that they could get harmed. Well, it's expensive to put up a railing around a fence, right? Did you know that God told Moses that, A, it was still your duty as a homeowner to spend the money being less valuable than human life, to have a railing to protect your guests from falling off, a harm that you as the homeowner could foresee? Today, we have laws that say, you know what, if you've got a pool in your backyard, you have to fence it off. Perchance some minor child living in a nearby house could wander away, see the attractive nuisance of a swimming pool, and because you can foresee a harm that somebody could fall in a pool who's not a grown adult, today we have some similar rules requiring that certain hazards be fenced off. That comes from Deuteronomy 22, verse 8.
Randy Melcher with us here today on Crosstalk and looking at the very base for law and justification. Law laid down, consequences, penalty for that law. Well, we're going to kind of fast forward through here because you write Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. Now, as we look specifically at the trial of Jesus, you indicate that a trial of Jesus was necessary. Why is that? Why was a trial necessary?
Well, this is what's exciting is because you look at it and people say, you know, they ask, why did Jesus have to die? What was the importance of it? Well, it wasn't so much even that Jesus had to die. He had to die in a certain way. You know, we think today some people, they die from natural causes. Well, the problem that we have with that, Leviticus 16, for Jesus to be a sacrifice for us, the Mosaic code forbade you as a shepherd saying that, well, I'm going to offer this animal just died. I can't use it anymore. I'm going to offer that to God. No, Leviticus 16 said that Aaron shall kill the bullock for the sin offering. The animal must be slain. You could not use as a sacrifice. Jesus being the sacrifice for our sins, it was forbidden from being just a natural death. Well, what about an accidental death? What about something that happened that something kind of like that? Isaiah prophesied specifically, Isaiah 53:8, not that Jesus would accidentally die, but that he would be cut off from the land of the living. There would be an intentional homicide of Jesus. And actually, homicide isn't the right word. Because, you know, we think that, well, you know, forget the trial. What if Caiaphas, what if Pilate, hey, what if Judas decide, you know what, I'm just going to save everyone this trial. We're going to take care of this person who's claiming to be the king of the Jews. And they were going to run him through like they did, Brutus did to Caesar. John 10:18, Jesus himself said that no man taketh my life from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have the power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. Jesus said that nobody was going to kill him. In fact, several times mobs came and they were going to get to him before it was time. Jesus disappeared in their midst. And so this is what's fascinating, is that the only way that Jesus could be the sacrifice, he had to die, but in a judicially ordered way. And this is what's called capital punishment, a judicially ordered death of the Messiah for the people.
Randy Melchin, our guest here today on Crosstalk. We're talking about the trial of Jesus and specifically his book, Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. We're going to delve further into that after the break. You're listening to Crosstalk on the VCY American Network.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, scientist with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, now I've heard that sometimes germs evolve. Is this true?
Chris, this is a common claim that some germs acquire the ability to infect certain new species, or maybe they become resistant to drugs. But this is not evolution. In fact, it's really devolution, the loss of ability or the loss of genes to accomplish a certain purpose. A recent study showed that the whooping cough bacteria lost a certain suite of genes, which caused the animal host immune system not to recognize it. Now, a new animal can be infected, but is this evolution? What happens here is the loss of genes, not the gain of genes as evolution needs. What results is death, not life. While it doesn't fit the evolution view, it does fit the creation followed by the fall and the curse view, and that's the back to Genesis view.
Thanks for tuning in to Back to Genesis.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Our guest today, Randy Melcher. We're talking about the trial of Jesus, his book, Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. Randy, as we delve into this further here, tell us about the major players in the trial against Jesus.
Sure. This is what's neat as you look throughout the Bible. Sometimes the scary thing we found, especially looking at our Bible reading challenge, only one out of four born-again church-going Christians has read through the Bible more than once. And so part of it is helping people see we got to be reading through our Bible. But then as we're looking through it, as we notice some of these threads that are going through, we see some of these names mentioned here or there, but we don't realize how they're connected to a legal trial of Jesus. Now, to have a legal trial, you have to have a prosecutor, you have to have a jurisdiction, you have to have a judge, you have to have a jury. So what were the different jurisdictions that could have indicted Jesus? For Jesus, we saw that many people wanted him to die. We saw the religious leaders, the scribes, the political figures, they wanted this threat to the status quo gone. So how do they organize this? Well, to do this, there was three people who could have served as prosecutors under the jurisdiction. You had Caiaphas, the high priest, the head of the Sanhedrin. He was the enforcer of the Mosaic Code. Now, he was based in Jerusalem. So there, he's one of the judicial bodies that could have been supervising this trial. You also had Pontius Pilate that we know about, who was the ultimate one, the Roman prefect of Judea, and more importantly, Jerusalem. Now, where did Jesus base his ministry, though? Interestingly, Jesus based his ministry not in Jerusalem, but in Galilee. In Galilee, he was outside of the immediate jurisdiction of Caiaphas and Pilate, and in the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas, the Roman tetrarch. He was responsible for crimes in Galilee. He was based in Sepphoris, just 4 miles from Nazareth. Now, this is one of the things that as we're looking through some of these different trends, we're noticing some of these things. We call them secrets because it's not usually brought up in some of the commentaries. But here's one of the questions. Why didn't Herod prosecute Jesus? What took him 3 years before he actually even met Jesus? John the Baptist, early in his ministry, after just a few months, Herod had him arrested and had him beheaded. But Herod went over 3 years without seeing Jesus. What's interesting is, especially as we go throughout the Bible, in the Old Testament, there was a political figure that God used to protect the prophets of Israel. That's what's so amazing. God could have done it many different ways, but God used a political figure who was following God to hide them. The guy's name was Obadiah. Obadiah was there protecting hundreds of prophets during the time of Elijah and Ahab. What's interesting is that as we look through the New Testament account, it appears that God was able to use somebody to help run interference in Herod's court. Herod is a political figure, kind of had many different whims of the day. Somebody that was able to kind of redirect the attention. So as we're looking at that, we're trying to figure out, well, why would Herod be leaving Jesus alone? This political figure's name was Chuza. What's interesting is we only read about him a few different verses in the Bible. We read that his wife, now this is one of the steward of Herod, all right, somebody that's working in the Roman government. This wasn't a leader of the Jewish Liberation Front. This was somebody working for the oppressive Romans. And Luke 8:3 tells us that his wife was funding Jesus' ministry. I mean, first off, just stop and think about that. The creator of the world, the one who owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, was taking financial support from some of the women in the first century, tells us, Joanna, Susanna, and many of these others, that the creator of the world was humbled himself to where he was taking financial help from some of these people. God was able to use some of these generous people in the first century to accomplish his mission. Now, why was Joanna and Chuza so concerned with Jesus? What's interesting, in John 4:46, we read about the nobleman from Capernaum who came to Jesus early in his ministry. From looking at Bible geography, he walked about 8 hours to find Jesus. Here it is, it says that his son is in need of death, is on the verge of death. And he's traveling 8 hours one way, 8 hours back, spending 16 hours. Here it is, instead of being with his son for his last moments, is searching for Jesus. And he says, you know, he's begging Jesus to heal his son. Jesus tells him, hey, you know that greater than earthly issues is heavenly issues. This nobleman's overcome with grief. You know, and what's likely is it's probably even maybe his wife was the one who encouraged him to send him out. He maybe didn't have the full faith that coming to Jesus, like other people came to Jesus and said, hey, just speak the word and my servant will be healed. No, he's coming begging Jesus to heal. But what did Jesus tell him? He He told him to go thy way, thy son liveth. What's interesting is this nobleman probably didn't have as much faith to just ask Jesus to say the word, but it says here, he believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went his way. He didn't need to have a mountain full of faith, just being willing to believe what Jesus did and to obey. This one wasn't nearly as faithful as the centurion in Matthew, but because he obeyed, this man came back. Now, what's interesting, this idea of this nobleman, the Greek word is basilikos. Many of the commentators think this was a Jew serving as an official in a royal court. And so we look at Joanna, where we read about her husband was Chuza, Herod's steward. The technical term there is epitropos. What's interesting is that those two terms can overlap, that this was probably, this nobleman was probably Chuza that we read about later. Somebody who, his wife says, hey, go talk to this person. He can heal our son. He goes there, hey, come help me, help heal my son. Jesus says, go home. Your son will be healed. And because he had faith in Jesus, because he trusted and obeyed, Jesus healed him. Because of that, he was able to use, God used him in his position to perhaps deal with Herod. That whenever Herod would maybe get on board, that Herod was able to be directed by Chuza. And his wife, Joanna, was funding Jesus' ministry.
You also brought up Caiaphas.
Yes.
And you even asked the question, one of the things you bring up in your book was Nicodemus, a detective for Caiaphas. What even prompts that question?
Well, and that's what's fascinating. As you look throughout the Gospels, especially starting even with John the Baptist, was one of the first people who was out there preaching. And John the Baptist saw that the Sadducees and the Pharisees were coming after John the Baptist from the start. Caiaphas, as head of the religious state, is dedicated to preserving his status quo. His goal is to make sure that the Jewish people are still able to survive, the temple worship goes on, and there's false messiahs coming up. Now, being a high priest, all right, from a statistical perspective, if 100 people are claiming to be the Messiah, at least 99 of them are false messiahs. So for the most part, Caiaphas is doing a good job. He is protecting false messiahs from claiming to be the Messiah. However, and so that's why anytime there'd be somebody coming up, we read especially about John the Baptist, how the Pharisees and Sadducees came after him. Matthew 3:7, John warns them that they'll be cast into the fire. You know, that he's attacking them because they're judging some of the situations, but they weren't judging righteous judgment. But what's interesting here, especially as we read throughout this, after this very public baptism, what's fascinating is that Jesus all of a sudden disappears off the stage. And one of the earliest accounts we read of people talking to Jesus is Nicodemus. Nicodemus being one of the rulers of the Jews, being part of the Pharisees, somebody who was close to Caiaphas. As such, Nicodemus and Caiaphas, they're probably talking about how we dealing with some of these different threats. And so Nicodemus probably has multiple motives for meeting with Jesus. A personal searching, but probably, given his role in the Sanhedrin, his duty to protect the status quo of the nation, a duty to investigate. Can we bring Jesus in for questioning? We'd say it today would kind of be our phrase. And so Nicodemus probably volunteered, said, hey, let me talk to him. Now, what's interesting is we even read through the Bible similar examples of this. Philip was a liaison between the Greeks and Jesus in John 12. So maybe perhaps Nicodemus approached Philip and was able to arrange a private meeting. As we read about it, throughout the time of Jesus, we see all these different mentions where the Pharisees were around, the Sadducees were around. Even when Jesus was walking through the fields just picking up some corn to eat, the Pharisees were there. They weren't just there because they were gossips. They had a duty to maintain the peace of the order to build a criminal case against the Messiah.
Was it important for Caiaphas to somehow entrap Jesus?
Well, the early goal is to find a different way, to find a crime that they could do him. Mm-hmm. But as they had been watching him, they had not seen any crime. So then all of a sudden, they're trying to figure out, well, how can we get him? Eventually, then they try to come after him. They ask him, what about Caesar's? They throw out the coin. Should we give tribute to Caesar or not? They try to say, what's the greatest commandment? Several of these ways where they're finally trying to trap him. And that's what's amazing. So you finally get to the trial. They get desperate. They don't have any violation of the Mosaic Code. So they're trying to find people that can come together and come up. What's something that we can try him with?
So let's talk about that trial. Was it a religious trial that Jesus had? Was it a legal trial, or was it both?
Well, and so part of the time, a lot of time when you read books about the trial of Jesus, they talk about a lot of the things that went wrong. It was held at night. You didn't have a biased jury. The person, they were counting on Jesus' testimony to convict himself. And so many people have written, and there's some great works on how the trial was unjust. However, that ignores the fact that this was a legitimate trial. The Sanhedrin was the governing body of Israel. These were the people representing the nation of Israel before God. And when they brought Jesus before him, they were acting as Israel, declaring whether or not they would accept Jesus the Messiah. So as they're bringing before Jesus to him, they're looking and they're trying to figure out, all right, how can we come against him? The first charge they brought against him, some of the charges that we talk about in the book, some of the different things that they would have tried to go at him. They tried to accuse him of wizardry, a capital offense in Leviticus 20. They tried to accuse him of Sabbath breaking, Exodus 31, 14, and 15. They tried to accuse him of blasphemy. They tried to accuse him of false prophecy. So many of these things crafted which arguments they could use. The first argument that they tried to bring against him was false prophecy. Here Jesus said that if you destroyed the temple, he could rebuild it in 3 days. Now, the problem was their witnesses couldn't agree within themselves. Mm-hmm. Part of it's they didn't understand that he was prophesying about his resurrection. And what's fascinating is that the first part of the trial was on one of what Paul says was one of the key aspects of the gospel, that Jesus rose from the dead. Paul will later on say that if the resurrection is vain, we of all men are most miserable. The first part of the trial really points to the resurrection, Jesus' prophecy of it. But because they didn't understand, because their witnesses couldn't even agree, they couldn't agree if Jesus was saying, if you do it, I will do it. Who is the one going to destroy the temple? They then end up having to throw out this charge. And then they're scrambling, trying to figure out, because here it is. What's amazing, in the book we talk about the size of the Roman garrison, that they were outnumbering the disciples by factors of 50. Some scholars even think as many as 100 to 1, that for everyone in Jesus' retinue, there was 100 opposing agents there to surround Jesus because they want to make sure they got him this time. Here it is. You're a district attorney. You bring in the highest profile defendant in the land, and your case is falling apart in front of your face. I mean, this is a travesty. I mean, if you were a DA today, you wouldn't be reelected. No. But if you're the high priest, this is the biggest egg on your face you could imagine, that you've got the defendant, you've got the jury, you called in a favor from Pilate himself to loan you a Roman guard to take him, and you're not even sure you can indict him, much less convict him.
So ultimately, what was Jesus convicted of?
Well, ultimately, they try to look for this issue of blasphemy. And this is what's been fascinating. Throughout Jesus' time, he was very careful who he revealed himself to. He told Peter that flesh and blood hath not revealed to you, when Peter said that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, but my Father. He told the demons to shut up when they were talking and saying, hey, you're the Christ. He revealed himself to the woman at the well in Samaria by herself. Under Jewish law, you needed 2 or 3 witnesses. They had to be men to convict of the crime. He had to be careful because it was not yet his time. Finally, the Jews knew that he was getting, that there were statements he said that were close to it, but he had to be careful during his ministry, not before his time, to declare his identity, because otherwise he would be executed prematurely, not having fulfilled his messianic responsibilities. So finally, Caiaphas gets frustrated, and against all jurisprudence, we have the Fifth Amendment today. Our Fifth Amendment actually goes back to Jewish law, that you could not self-indict yourself. You could not convict yourself on your own testimony. You had a right to remain silent. Caiaphas asked Jesus, tell us plainly, art thou the Christ, the Son of the living God? Now, Jesus could have been silent, but this was the time, and Jesus declared, I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man returning on the clouds. Fascinating. It wasn't just that he pled, but there's 2 specific elements of this that we'll talk about on the other side of the break.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Back in just 1 minute, Randy Melchert is our guest, Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. By the way, we'll tell you how you can obtain a copy of the book as well as a DVD presentation on the subject as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back here on Crosstalk.
The New England Primer was introduced in Boston in 1690 by Benjamin Harris. It was the first textbook printed in America. For a century after its introduction, it was the beginning textbook for students, and until well into the 20th century, it continued to be a principal text in all types of American schools. The founders, as well as millions of other Americans, learned to read from the New England Primer and the Bible. The core of the primer is its rhyming alphabet, such as for letter A, in Adam's fall, we send all. The letter G, as runs the glass, man's life doth pass. It also included lessons for youth, Bible questions, and a shorter catechism. A pocket-size hardcover edition of this 1777 historical reprint is available for a donation of $9 or more by calling VCY at 1-800-729-9829. Ask for the New England Primer.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America, and folks, the clock, it's the best of us here. There is so much information, but tell you what, you have an opportunity to pick it up through a book as well as a DVD on this very issue. Randy has authored the book Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. This book is one in which you'll be able to go through much more detail the very issues we're talking about. It's close to 200 pages in length, and we are making this available through Crosstalk as our way of saying thank you for your support of $12 or more. But Randy has also done a DVD on the trial of Jesus that is approximately
1 hour.
1 hour in length. And this also is available. Now, if you want the DVD on the trial of Jesus, that's available for a donation of $12. But if you'd like both the DVD and the book, we're putting together them in a set. It's available for a donation of $20. And if you'd like to obtain it, you can call our switchboard here at VCY America at 1-800-729-9829. Again, the book Secrets of the Trial of Jesus is available for donation of $12. A DVD on the teaching, this PowerPoint's involved with that as well. The Trial of Jesus, that's available separately as a donation of $12. But if you want both together, you can get it as a set for a donation of $20. You would just ask for the set, and all you need to do is call 1-800-729-9829. That's during business hours, 1-800-729-9829. Randy, we were talking about the aspect of Jesus being convicted and ultimately what he was convicted of, and you're talking about blasphemy in all of this, and you mentioned that Jesus had a couple defenses available to him. Tell us about that.
Sure. Especially when you're going before court and you plead, here it is, the high priest is asking Jesus, are you the Christ, Son of living God? Jesus says, I am. Now, normally we would say he's pleading guilty, he's going to submit to their punishment. However, there's two defenses that Jesus had and he's introducing. The first is called sovereign immunity. This comes from the Latin phrase rex non potest peccare, basically meaning the king can do no wrong. The king in your classical eras created the law. Therefore, a commoner could not sue the king for violating the law. The king was over the law. In America, we actually still have this, that you need the consent of the U.S. government to sue the federal government. What we have it basically going down to is that if Jesus is the sovereign of the situation, you cannot charge the sovereign for violation of one of the sovereign's laws. And so this is what Jesus introduced. At Mark 14:62, Jesus said, I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Now, what did he mean by this clouds of heaven? He's talking about Daniel 7:13 and 14, where Daniel saw in the night visions, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him, and there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Jesus right there claimed to be the sovereign of the universe. His claim was not just, I'm guilty of your crime. His claim was, I'm who you say I am, but I am your sovereign. Jesus wasn't saying, hey, that, you know, I'm okay to be executed here. He says, if you understand who I am your creator. That idea of sovereign immunity was one of his first pleas. Now, the other aspect that he could have introduced, but he didn't do it at that point, was, no, let's put ourselves in a defense lawyer's chair. Let's assume, hypothetically, that we were charged with representing Jesus. You know what? We could have brought in witnesses to this accusation. Now, what you have is an affirmative defense. So let's say somebody's breaking your house, has a gun pointed at you, and, you know, is demanding all your money. If you shoot him in self-defense, that's you shot him, but you have an affirmative defense to protect yourself. So what you have here is if you're claiming to be the Messiah, The claim would normally be, because as we said, if there's 100 people claiming to be the Messiah, at least 99 of them are false. So while the presumption would be that it was a false claim, could he prove it? Now, this was the issue that you had, is how do you prove it? All right. So what you saw is the clearest example you have is what John the Baptist did. In the book, we talk about leprosy and we talk about some of the other things, but the clearest example is what John the Baptist did. Matthew 11:3, John's wondering, hey, if the kingdom of God is coming, why am I still in prison? You know, I thought I was going to be the one bringing in the kingdom for you, preparing the way for the kingdom. Here I am in some inferior king's dungeon. And he sends his disciples and asks, art thou he that should come, or should we look for another? Jesus said, you know, what's interesting is Jesus didn't speak anything first. What he did is he first healed the people. He healed them because Isaiah 35:4-6 said, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. What will be the signs? The eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame leap as a hart, the tongue of the dumb sing, the wilderness shall break out. What happened? In that same hour, he cured many of infirmities and plagues and evil spirits. Unto many that were blind, he gave sight, Luke 7:21 says. All right, these are people that we could have brought in as witnesses. And Jesus, understanding the Old Testament prophecy, communicating it. John, who many think was even studied with the Essenes, those who translated the Dead Sea Scrolls, that he had studied with them, would have been fluent with these prophecies. Jesus told him, go and show John those things which you do hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers cleansed, the deaf hear, the poor of the gospel preached. We could have brought in witnesses, and we've got a fascinating talk in the book as well about even the controversy of where Jesus was born, but this could have been the defense case for Jesus' claim to be Messiah.
So Jesus was accused and convicted of blasphemy. Is this a Roman crime worthy of capital punishment?
No, blasphemy wasn't a crime because the Romans had many gods. You wanted to be God, great. As long as you said that Caesar was a god too, they were fine. And so then all of a sudden, Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin's role flip. No longer are they the jury. Now they're the prosecutor. They have to go before Caiaphas and scrambling again because they have to deliver something, a Roman crime. They had promised him to get the Roman guard. They had to have promised that this was going to be a Roman crime that we'd have had too. And so then they try to bring up the crime of treason, that Jesus is claiming to be king in place of Caesar. So again, we have a challenge here. Pilate asks him, art thou the king of the Jews? And again, Jesus takes two different attacks. We go into more depth. The jurisdiction. If Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. You know, if somebody's claimed to be king of Narnia, you can't indict him for treason against America if their claim is of a different place. So there's a jurisdictional issue. But then again, you have again this affirmative defense. Was Jesus the king of the Jews? And what's fascinating, if we were to have a full defense, you know what's fascinating is we could have brought in the angel Gabriel as one of the witnesses. The angel Gabriel told Mary that he would be the king of the Jews. I mean, the incredible case that's laid on the Bible, but for the purposes of Jesus being our substitute, Jesus didn't bring in these witnesses. Jesus submitted. Jesus laid down his life and let them convict him. Let them sentence him to death, the death of the cross, so he could pay our punishment.
That is the real focus.
Yes.
And that's the focus of the book, is why Jesus came. And that's really, bottom line, the important truth for us to grasp.
That is. And especially as believers, as we look through the New Testament, we can piece together these pieces. You know, was Jesus really God? I mean, that's the question that our friends have. And we can look through the New Testament. We can see the facts for it. We can see the case for it. And we can see that it wasn't Jesus on trial that day. It was us. Those people who were voting to condemn him to die, they were the ones condemning themselves. You know what? Someday we're going to be on trial for our sins. Satan's going to be prosecuting. He's going to show all the violations of the law that we've done. If we accept Jesus as our Savior, as our substitute, when we're sinned before him on Judgment Day, he's not just our great Savior, our substitute. He's our great lawyer. He is our advocate who will be sitting at the table with us. You know what? Today, they say that the O.J. Simpson trial defense cost between $3 and $5 million. Jesus, the very Son of God, will represent us. The technical term is pro bono, for free. He will represent us. We don't even have to claim anything. We don't have to speak. He will represent us, and he will point that he paid the penalty for us. All we have to do is what the gospel points out, that he died for us. He was buried. He rose again. He came to save us.
Randy Melchert, our guest today. Our phone line here at a Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. Perhaps you have a question you'd like to ask, a comment on the issue today. Again, our number, 1-800-733-9829. You've got much more in your book than time allows, but what is your hope that this book will accomplish?
Especially as we're reading through the Bible, that we can take a better interest in it. Sometimes, too often, some people, even who try to read through the Bible every year, your eyes just gloss over the pages. Be looking for some of these different strands. Nicodemus, why does Nicodemus' name keep popping up? Why do these other people's name keep popping up? Why the whole focus, the entire legal code of the Old Testament, the judicial nature of the New Testament, focus on Jesus' substitutionary atonement for us? Jesus died in our place so that guilty men, condemned to die, imminently awaiting execution, could go free. He took our place. This is a message that we can be sharing with people, that he came to save us. He's our great savior, and he's our great lawyer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we don't even have to argue all these issues. Jesus will speak for us. Jesus died for us. He will even speak for us. This is what's so exciting, is to just take a bigger appreciation of what Jesus has done for us.
Our phone number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. That's 800-733-9829. Let's go to have some open lines here. Joe is calling from Union Grove, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
I have a question for the speaker.
Yes,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yes. I've always thought this was kind of strange, and it kind of goes with everything that you've said on the show, but when Caiaphas asked Jesus, "Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" and he answered affirmatively, Caiaphas ripped his clothes and said, "What more evidence do we have? You know, he's guilty of blasphemy." But from the text, how was he guilty of blasphemy? They didn't prove that he was guilty of blasphemy. They just wanted him to be guilty, but they had no necessary proof. So how could the Sanhedrin, just, you know, taking that and Caiaphas ripping his clothes, just conclude, okay, yeah, he's guilty, when no valid proof was given?
They didn't lay out a charge. And you're exactly right. This was a bad trial. There was no arguments laid out. They did not bring any witnesses in claiming that he made a public statement. And that's what we point out, is that Jesus was careful in who he communicated the truth to. And that's why in this trial, their only evidence was Jesus' confession. Jesus' confession was the only evidence they had for his crucifixion. And that is what they brought up for it, was just his words.
And those words, even using those words, "I am," yes, had significance to them.
Yes, that he was claiming that the words referred to when God revealed himself to Moses, "I am that I am." Mm-hmm. But using that, under our system today, we have the Fifth Amendment today. The Jews had, you read through some of the different rabbinical writings, that it was seen as the greatest travesty of justice to have some of these violations where you could not use his testimony against him. Here, they were so desperate. They'd been working for years, and their case was so flimsy that it had fallen apart, that they were willing to jump on the fact of his confession and say, yeah, we don't need any other witnesses, even though under Old Testament Mosaic law, you said you need two or three witnesses, and the person testifying was ineligible because he's confessing against himself. Mm-hmm. But they skipped past that and said, all right, we're just going to convict him off of this.
Thank you, Joe. Our phone number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. That's 1-800-733-9829. If you have a question or a brief comment, 800-733-9829. If you'd like to get the book, the DVD, we'll give you information after the break on that as well. This is Crosstalk on VCY America, Secrets of the Trial of Jesus, our topic today. Back in just 1 minute on the VCY America Network.
For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewradio.com. We've been doing a series on our broadcast network, Brainwashing. We found this, a 1956 report that's been declassified by the CIA. Here's what it said, quote, "It should be noted that brainwashing, so defined, does not emphasize what happens to the individual, but what happens within him. The change represents a more or less complete re-education of his value system. This change is brought about in a rigidly controlled environment using pressure designed to create and sharpen internal conflict within the individual. The individual is forced to resort to a problem-solving behavior, and the net effect is the brainwashed state. End quote. My friends, that's been going on in America for generations. Problem solving. Who gets thrown out of the lifeboat? Reorganizing their values.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Randy Melchert is our guest today, author of this book, The Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. And I want to quickly mention this one more time, that if you'd like to get a copy of the book, nearly 200 pages in length, it is available for our way of saying thank you for your support of $12 or more to Crosstalk. Just ask for the book, Secrets of the Trial of Jesus. But he's got a PowerPoint presentation on DVD that's been recorded on this, and you'll learn a lot of information through the DVD. That's called The Trial of Jesus. That's available for donation of $12. But if you'd like them both together, rather than 24, it's in a package, the offer here today, you can get the set for a donation of $20. The way to get it is to call our main switchboard during business hours, 1-800-729-9829. That's 1-800-729-9829. Let's go back to the phone lines here. We've got Mike calling next from Bayview. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Jim and Randy. I just wanted to tell you, I filmed that for Randy, that PowerPoint, the Trial of Jesus. And he had my attention from the second he started talking to the end. And I'll tell you, I can't wait to get it. Especially with Resurrection Sunday coming up, it is just absolutely a must-have set of information to give to talk to people about. I thought it was great myself.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, kudos to Randy for that. God bless.
Okay, thanks for the call. Grand Junction, Colorado. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, very glad to hear the topic of the program today. I heard a message by John MacArthur many years ago in which he talked about the illegal trial. Does your author refer to in the book the march to the cross, as it were, in which the stages at which if the an acquittal or a reversal was ordered was discussed? I found that fascinating. I'm going to get the book. Do you recall, or is this anything you are aware of in your research the trial?
Thank you, Richard.
Other people focused on different aspects. In fact, one of the leading works on the whole trial of Jesus was a congressman from the United States around the turn of the century. The book wasn't published for 50 years. The trial of Jesus has been an incredible aspect. There's great resources. We haven't focused on some of the different aspects at that time for appeal. What's interesting is we point out in the book, we actually talk about how there will be a future rehearing of the trial of Jesus. We'll talk about in Revelation and Zechariah where it's been prophesied. But we've been focusing just kind of actually on the actual nature of the trial. There was many illegalities, but sometimes we skip the fact that this was actually the official tribunal. Even though it was done in a poor manner, Jesus was condemned by an official trial of the official governing body. So that was kind of our focus, is that in spite of the illegalities, that it was still a genuine trial.
Great. Thank you, Richard. Oop, I lost him. Bob in Sussex, Wisconsin. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello. Going through Leviticus, is there a definition of blasphemy? Because I understand there was a young man who was cursed using God's name and was stoned to death. But is there a good definition somewhere?
Part of it goes back to kind of the first commandment there, that thou shalt have no other gods before me. So that's kind of the accusation that if somebody is claiming to be God, that's a violation of your ultimate first commandment there. It's not necessarily specified out. The bigger danger you had in Leviticus was people leading with false prophecy. More people were claiming to be prophets of God than claiming to be the God himself. So that was kind of where your main issue was. So it wasn't so much on, you didn't have it too much during the Mosaic times, but it goes back to just the first commandment. There's only one God. If you're claiming to be that one, then you're starting to get it even to the second commandment, a graven image of God. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's a fascinating topic.
And then don't take his name in vain.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Bob. Randy, you mentioned this rehearing of Jesus. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is what's fascinating. An American system, all right, let's say you go to the Supreme Court with your case. You argue your Supreme Court, you lose at the Supreme Court. There's nobody else you can appeal to. You reach the highest court in the United States. However, we have a 1852 Supreme Court ruled that, well, you can't have a rehearing unless some member of the court changes their opinion. This is called Supreme Court Rule 44. A petition for hearing will not be regranted except by a majority of the court the instance of a justice who concurred in the judgment or decision. So what we're seeing, what we hear prophesied in the Bible, in Revelation 12, it tells us that there's going to be a time where the woman is going to be taken to the wilderness to a place prepared of God for the 1,260 days. In Zechariah, it says, Zechariah 9:16, that the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people, for there shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as ensign upon the land. All right, even non-dispensationalists say that, hey, there's going to be in the future, there's this event where the nation of Israel is going to turn to God, specifically to Jesus. Now, where will this be? Isaiah 63:1 seems to imply that this place is going to be in the Edom, Basra area. Many think that this is Petra. But what we read in Zechariah 12:10, it tells us about this time that they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. Zechariah has prophesied this hundreds of years before the crucifixion, that there would be a time in the future, and this will fulfill Paul's prayer, Romans 10:1, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel, that they might be saved.
And Randy, as we look at it, the real focus of your book is why Jesus came, and that's the important truth for us to grasp.
Yes, he came to pay our penalty. We were guilty sinners, condemned to die because of our sins, facing an imminent death penalty. He came to earth. He laid his life down. He didn't bring up a defense attorney. He didn't bring up a defense case. We'll show the defense cases he could have produced. But he submitted himself to the death of the cross. So that way, he could be our great savior. But what's even more exciting is that he's, in addition, our great lawyer. He will be the one speaking for us. He will be representing us for free. That he will be able to, when Satan's accusing us, if we have put our trust in him, if we have accepted him, and that's what the trial of Jesus was. It wasn't, Jesus wasn't on trial. We're the ones on trial. What will we do with Jesus?
Amen. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Randy Melchert put together the book Secrets of the Trial of Jesus and also the DVD, The Trial of Jesus, individually. They're available for donation of $12. Or if you'd like it together as a set, both a copy of the book and the DVD, it's available for donation of just $20. Our way of saying thank you for your support to Crosstalk. All you need to do is contact our switchboard at 800-729-9829. That's 1-800-729-9829. And ladies and gentlemen, we trust as you listen today and as you review these materials that you understand that Jesus came to pay the price for your sin on the cross of Calvary. By believing in him can have everlasting life. Jesus Christ indeed, our advocate. Thanks so much for joining us here today on Crosstalk.
Been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.